I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The signature sound of the young Louis Armstrong, a sweaty bar in Chicago in the 20s, Prohibition gin in paper cups, not the place that you'd go looking for that fictional Dublin street lad, the IRA thug Henry Smart. But Roddy Doyle, in his latest book, has sent his man to America at perhaps its time of greatest promise. A time when anyone, it seems, could become an American. Just as Henry Smart makes his way to Chicago, Louis Armstrong is hustling his way to the top, and Doyle takes the license of fiction to link these two characters.
The trumpet went to the mouth. The arm brought it up without seeming to bend. He turned to the band. Baby Dodds hit the rim of the big drum, and the trumpet walked them into a dirty piece of blues that cleared the floor, then filled it again with the brave ones. The eyes were closed, the sweat rolled right over them. I watched him wipe his face while the trombone took a turn. That was the difference between the music when he was there and the music when he wasn't. When he wasn't in on it, there were no turns, no solos. The players galloped along without them. It was tight, it was great, but it was anonymous. When he was there, they stepped out at the circle and had a go. Names were made, sounds were invented. The trombone now rode every woman in the house and stepped back for a rest and a wash. And Armstrong put the horn to his mouth and played it like it hurt.
And that is Roddy Doyle himself reading from his new book, Oh, Play That Thing. We'd like to have you join us this hour. Is America still writing its own story and its mix of immigrants? Or are those days of promise past? What happens when the fictional characters of a writer's imagination meet the real-life people and places of history? Is there some kind of natural affinity between the Irish of the British Empire and African-Americans here? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Roddy Doyle is here with me in the studios. Nice to hear you read. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
This music of Louis Armstrong was something that it sounds like it got under your skin in the preparation of the book.
It well and truly infected me, I've got to say, yeah. I didn't know much about him when I set out to write the book. I just read a review in some paper about a review of a biography of Armstrong, and it had this great story, a striking story about when he was leaving New Orleans, where he grew up, and he was leaving when he was about 19 or 20 to go to Chicago. A bouncer in a club said to him, if you're going to make it up there, Louis, find yourself a white man who'll put his hand on your shoulder and say, this here is my black man. And I thought, you know, this was before I even started the book, maybe I'd make Henry that white man. So that's where it started from. But I knew very little about Armstrong. I'd seen him on TV when I was a kid, mm-hmm. and my parents would light up every time he was on, say, the Andy Williams show. This elderly man, very, very, you know, benign and nice, and he'd sing on the good nights, It's a Wonderful World. And on the bad nights, quote a Hello Dolly. You know? But that's as much. And I knew in the abstract sense that he had his important place in the history of popular music, but I didn't really know much about him.
We are a little bit ahead of ourselves here, though. I couldn't help but begin by listening to that music and hear you describe the link. The story actually begins Ellis Island,
yeah.
New York, the arrival in America of someone who we last knew, I think a favorite character of yours, Henry Smart. You like this guy, don't you?
Yeah, well, I'd have to really, because I've been writing about him for 8 years, and there's probably a good bit left because I have to write the final volume. So.
This is the second of a trilogy, I should point out.
Yeah, so it's just as well. I do like him. I do, you know, he's human and he's flawed. And I found in the second volume, and it was important that I continued to do it, that boastful part of his nature began to get on my wick. But, I mean, I'm creating him, so it wasn't as if I could throw him out of the house. But he's flawed in the same way any human being is. But I do like him, essentially, yeah.
1924, America, you write, was bigger than the States, bigger than the world, the city of the good time, the big noise. A good place to push Henry in?
Yeah, very much so, because he had to leave Ireland. He didn't have a choice. The choice was stark, stay and die or leave. And he went at first to England, but it wasn't far enough away. Liverpool is very much an Irish city. There were men in trench coats with weighted pockets, you know, at every corner looking at him as he walked by.
Now, he'd been a hitman for the IRA at the time of the Easter Uprising. Why was he then in the early 20s? Why had the tables turned? Why were people after him?
Well, as he thought, this man, this kind of IRA intellectual, explained it to him, that now that the revolution had been won, they were going to get respectable pretty quickly, so there was no place for the Henrys of this world anymore, so they were going to bump him off, because he was in the way, and he was a dirty story, because the gunmen were now going to put on suits and become statesmen. So he has to go, and he does. But eventually he goes to America. I could have sent him east and it would have been in its way fascinating. He could have gone to Germany, for example, in the 20s and 30s. But I felt that that's not the way he would have gone. And, I personally would have been more interested and more confident as the writer in sending him to America. Because he does want to disappear. He wants to stop being Irish and the burden that is, particularly at that time. He wants to shed it and become something new, and America seems to be the place where that can happen.
There's something really sort of energetic and exciting about his first introduction to the city. I wonder if I can ask you to read us a bit of Oh, Play That Thing, where he's, I guess, what would you say at this point, Roddy, just beginning to make his way in the city?
Trying to find... Yeah, he's making his way, discovering the city, trying to come to grips with its complexity, the smallness of it for a start. Manhattan is very small, and the complexity of it, and trying to find somewhere for himself in it all. I walked until my ears felt very far from home, to East Harlem and another job. I read the newspapers to Puerto Rican cigar makers in a loft on 109th Street. These men rolled tobacco leaves and learnt their English 12 hours a day, and I, their lector, read the Daily Worker, the Daily News and the Saturday Evening Post, my head swimming in the gorgeous stink of the world's best tobacco. As they got to know me and my voice, they brought in books of their own that their daughters had got for them from the branch library. Les Miserables, The Jungle and MacTeague, and they learned to gasp and cry in English, and they lingered long after they were knee-deep in panatellas and listened until I got to the end of a book or chapter. I read in a fog of tobacco sweat for more than a month, but I walked again. I left when one of those small men put a knife to my throat. I just closed The Call of the Wild with 5 pages to go. I had to pick it up and finish it while the blade leaned into my neck. I walked downtown through the night, and early the next morning, the air from the East River tempting me to the docks, I was saved by an undertaker. He was struggling with a heavy roll of canvas, and curious and hungry, I stopped and helped him, up narrow steps and more steps, into a small room full of good dark furniture and a dead man. He thanked me, took off his stovepipe hat, wiped his head with a kerchief that shone like a mirror, and offered me a job. So I started hefting for him. Mr. Grass's caskets came with mourners, if wanted, lace curtains for the windows, and backdrops, landscapes on old canvas, badly painted chunks of home, a Sicilian village, the Tower of London, a river that passed for any of the thousands that had been left behind. The one I'd carried for him was the river. I thought it was the Liffey at the Strawberry Beds as I watched him hoist it behind the dead man on the table. But no, he said, today it was the Danube. 5-6 times out of 10, it is the Volga. Is there ever the Shannon? I asked. One time, said Mr. Grass. The departed admired the tenor voice of John McCormack, but he himself was Polish. He gave me a stovepipe hat and taught me how to say I'm sorry for your troubles in 11 different languages. I buried his share of the Lower East Side dead, with his brother and now and again his son.
That's Roddy Doyle reading from his new book, Oh, Play That Thing. It's the second in a trilogy. The first one is called A Star Called Henry. You know Roddy Doyle's work from his book, The Commitments, Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, which won the Booker Prize in 1993. And as the people who watch your work carefully will point out, you've been pretty close to home until we took Henry abroad. Did that mean that you had to do some traveling on your as well to set these scenes?
Yeah, well, any excuse to come to America, it's always great. But yeah, I did have to do a certain amount of travel, but remarkably less than I thought I would have to do. It's amazing what you can get from books, for example. So I read probably the best help. There were two things that were of most help to me: reading contemporary fiction, for example, and looking at photographs. The sandwich board. Henry eventually gets a job as a sandwich board man. That idea came from looking at a photograph. There's a scene later on during the Great Depression where Henry watches a family getting on board a boxcar. The inspiration for that came from looking at a photograph. Again, at this desperate-looking woman trying to cling to her dignity as she sits beside a railway embankment with her children in burlap sacks around her. The contemporary fiction, The Streets of Harlem, really came alive for me in a book called Home to Harlem by Claude McKay. And Chicago, the Studs Lonergan books, They were a great help, the way people spoke. So you can do that all that at home, you know.
But the interesting thing about it, though, Roddy, is that the America that you're describing of the 20s and the 30s is not really here anymore. I mean, it's all been knocked down, torn over, built up once and probably knocked down and built on top, which is a part of the kind of America that Henry Smart discovers.
It's exactly what he wants, you know. And in a way, as a novelist, it was fine by me as well. So I went to the south side of Chicago. State Street is still there. But I think bar one, every building that had housed a club, a jazz club, is demolished. All the famous landmarks, they're gone. And at one level, that was very disappointing because it seemed like a long way to go to find an empty space. But on the other hand, as a novelist and somebody who makes it up, I was quite pleased. You know, I was reluctant to concede it, but I was quite pleased because then I could do exactly that again by listening to the music, by using my own experience of, you know, listening to music in a hot room, and by using photographs again. I could build up, you know, fictional clubs instead of, you know, being a slave to reality. So probably the place that's easy to evoke by just standing in a street and looking around is the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And there's a tenement museum there, which was powerful, because when I mentioned Henry going up narrow steps in a house, I mean, I probably in the first draft hadn't mentioned the word narrow, but when you go to the tenement museum, which is a glorious building, the narrowness of everything, really, the fact that you can't really go anywhere without rubbing a wall, you know, and the darkness of it, and just the sheer dimensions of it, were a great, great help to me, you know.
There's a part of me that wondered why it is that Henry succeeds the way that he does, because although he's connected with the powerful in Ireland, when he does reinvent himself, he comes on his own. He comes with nothing, skims his passport across the river the moment that he's through immigration. Yep. And New York was a pretty terrifying place at the same time. I mean,
but he was a street kid himself. He grew up on the streets of Dublin. You know, Dublin is a small city compared to New York, but a city is a city. So he knows the rules, really. And part of his brashness is that he's utterly self-confident. You know, and he wouldn't be terrified. He wouldn't be terrified. He'd see opportunity where other people would cower. So what happens is eventually he's very naive, extremely naive. And I kept reminding myself, he's also very, very young. He's been through a lot of living, and he's killed people, but he's still in his early 20s when he arrives, you know. So he's still very, very young. Slightly, he starts employing kids to do the boards, to carry the boards for him. And he reminds the reader as well that he's only a little bit older than these kids, you know. So, but he does have this confidence. But what he eventually discovers is that it's not the New World at all, really, that the Lower East Side of Manhattan is like a series of villages, European villages, and people got there a long time before him, you know, so that he eventually, not, you know, typically enough, he finds himself in trouble quite early.
He's a bit wise to that by the time he gets to Chicago and runs into the Italian mob at that time. We're going to take a short break here and come back, talk a little bit more about this new book, Oh, Play That Thing. Roddy Doyle is the author. He's here with me in the studio, bringing one of his distinctive Irish characters to America at a time when this country really was being built by immigrants. What does it tell us about how the country is put together right now? Is that still something that's possible? Come here, become American, 1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Just the sort of soundtrack that you would expect to accompany a conversation with an Irish author about an IRA thug moving to America. My guest this hour, Roddy Doyle. We're talking about his new book, Oh, Play That Thing. Music of Louis Armstrong there in the background, and at one point in the book, without giving away too much of it, our character, Henry Smart, becomes pretty close with Louis Armstrong, and Roddy told us the story about where that idea came from. But I do want to just go back a little bit to try and figure out whether or not you saw some deeper affinity between what Louis Armstrong was or hoped to be and what Henry Smart, because they were pretty close to the same age at that time.
They're exactly, they within a few months, they're the exact same age, if that makes sense.
it's fiction. You can do whatever you want. You put them together, maybe just by chance, but by putting them together, you create something, some kind of consideration about who they are and what they represent.
Yes. It's about race, I suppose. It's about identity. Armstrong knew that if he wanted to do what he wanted to do, if he wanted creative independence, he had a strong sense of what he was at and what he was capable of. But that would not be recognized and that would not be respected unless he had this white man beside him. And he hopes that Henry would be that white man. He doesn't want a manager, you know. He doesn't want somebody to control him. But he knows that in the world he's living in, that if he wants to walk in the front door of the club that he's playing in, he needs to have to walk side by side with a white man.
And what is Louis Armstrong then to Henry Smart? How is he of value to Henry? Is he a ticket to America? Is he kind of an...
In a sense, yes. When Henry hears the music, he really feels that he has arrived, that this is newness, this is brand spanking new. Music to Henry in the past has been, you know, Irish music, either lamenting a lost battle or marching into a new one, you know. the blighted spuds or the possibility of a good dinner. That's part of his past. But right. Here he hears, you know, people from the same background, if you like, because you scratch Armstrong and you'll find a peasant, you know. And here you have somebody celebrating.
Well, they are street thugs together at the very beginning. I mean, they're doing break-ins and...
They're both street kids. You know, Armstrong was very much a street kid. And they're both very similar in that regard. I also wanted... I didn't think in terms of it being historical either. It was... Ireland has changed remarkably in the last few years in that it's gone from being a place that exported people to a place that's now so wealthy that people are queuing up to get in. And it's no longer safe to define an Irish person from the Republic as being white and Catholic. So that, you know, I could throw a stone in O'Connell Street now and chances are I'd hit a Nigerian who's been living there for 6 years and has two kids who were born in Ireland. And those kids are going to have more kids. So I was keen to try to get Henry to rub shoulders with somebody from way beyond his own culture. And even though he's been in America years, he hasn't actually spoken to a black man before. And he speaks to a woman who he doesn't think is either black or white. And he thinks this is brand new as well. And she's been plonked right there for him. And she puts him right very, very quickly about, you know, the reality of life.
Explains that he's not even supposed to be in the bar that he's in that night. Given night, yeah. Because that's African-American night as opposed to the rest of the
week.
Yes,
yeah. And then they're in a black and tan. They go to a black and tan. And for any Irishman of that generation, the term black and tan is frightening because they were a mercenary force that were sent to, you know, teach the Irish manners. And whereas a black and tan club was where someplace under strict rules where black and white people could mix. So I just... I was keen to explore the limits that they could how far they could go, the contrast of the music, and just to see how they could influence each other.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Roddy Doyle is here with me in the Connection Studio. We're talking about his work, his new book, his Oh, Play That Thing, to Lexington, Massachusetts, for our first call. And Stuart's on the line. Hi, Stuart.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking me. I want to first of all tell Roddy Doyle that he's one of my absolutely favorite writers.
Thank you.
It's a delight to be able to talk to him. I wanted to let me also say that I think Patty Clark is one of the sweetest and saddest books that I've ever read, and I wish everyone knew about it. Roddy, I'd like to ask you about the father in The Commitments, who was a great fan of Elvis Presley. That seemed to be extraneous to the story, but had quite a bit of importance to the character. Where did that come from?
The father's love of Elvis Presley, I think, probably comes from myself. I love Elvis. I've written three books for children, and there's a reference to Elvis Presley in all three. There's a chapter dedicated to Elvis, and a claim that he lives in a garden shed in my back garden. So it's something, I don't know, Elvis is a complicated and a wonderful figure. And
very American.
Extremely American, and I love the music. And one of the great recent discoveries, I suppose, if recent can be, 10 years, was finding out that life didn't stop after he went into the army, that actually a lot of the music he created later on is also very, very good. So I just like Elvis Presley. And the thing about Elvis as well is that you cannot help but laugh at times, that he is such a complicated figure, that there's the glory of, human creativity and the absurdity of an awful lot of human life within the same figure as well. So I just liked the people are often surprised. They come to Ireland and they see all these kids walking around in Manchester United jerseys. And then they go into homes, and instead of the Pope being up on the wall, there's a picture of John Wayne. They can never quite figure it out. And Elvis Presley would be very much a revered figure in Ireland. Not by everybody by any means, but a lot of working class men now, if you walk around, they still aspire to Presleydom, if you know what I mean. They'd still love to be Elvis Presley as he was, say, in 1957.
There's a link, though, that Stuart puts me in mind of, and that is the place, the kind of high place that music occupies in the writing that you do. I mean, we'll talk a little bit more in this program about your writing style and the jazz that is a part of it, but this began with the Commitments and the music that you were writing about that band was doing as well.
Yeah, it was again Black American music of a different type, of not all that different, though. I think one of the discoveries again is that there's not all that much difference between the jazz as played by Armstrong and the soul that was played by the people at Motown. The soul was a bit stricter, but it was the same basically brilliant music, you know. Guess you better
slow the Mustang down. I remember reading a piece about the movie The Commitments from the soundtrack, and people said you could not leave that film and have this song back in your mind for over the next week.
Well, I became a hero, and I was a high school teacher, and I was a hero for a couple of days because I organized a screening before it was released, a screening for the school. And it went down very well, and they were sent home. They didn't have to go back to school, so I was everybody's favorite teacher for a while. But three kids came in to me on the day after. I didn't teach them, I knew them to see, but I didn't teach them. And they sidled up to the desk. I was doing corrections or something. And they said, it was a great film. I said, thanks very much, lads, thanks. And they hung around for a while, and one of them said, will you write a song for our band?
Did you have to explain them?
I did. I shouldn't have. In retrospect, I should have said, yeah, sure.
I knocked that stuff
off. Rob somebody else's song and give it to them. But for a while, there were three kids in Dublin who thought I'd written Mustang Sally.
Might as well take credit for that. 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour, Roddy Doyle. We're talking about his new book, Oh, Play That Thing. Lansing, Michigan is next. And Kathy's on the line from there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I'm having a ball listening to your conversation. I am a music teacher, and I think that I wanted to respond to your comment about whether people coming to the U.S. become Americans now versus like when my grandparents came here.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's the same thing because my grandparents, my grandfather, his family came from Germany. They did not speak German in the house, although his parents, the kids weren't allowed to speak German. Because his parents said, no, we're Americans now. You know, you're going to be American. And my other set of grandparents came from Ireland. And there was this real push, that we have to be Americans. And now, especially being an elementary music teacher, I find that multiculturalism is extremely important. And
is there not, though, underlying that or overlaying that at some level, though, Kathy, an agreement that moving to the country means accepting a certain amount of either the English language or Americanness or whatever the myths and the stories or the music of the country is?
I think there is, but I think people are more interested in bringing their heritage with them. And, you see more of, you have the Irish American Club and the Polish American Club and, African Americans really want that. Well, I don't know if they do, but the PC term is, that you use the African with the American. And there's much more of a push towards looking at our roots and, far back, as well as the fact that we live in this country and there are certain things that we do and the ways that we speak here as well.
I'm wondering, Kathy, I thank you for your call. I'm wondering, as Kathy speaking, whether or not in this modern-day Ireland that you're describing, which is now a home to immigrants rather than a place that people are leaving, are you seeing the same sort of thing? We're going to come here, we're going to be Irish?
It's one of the issues that is, it's happened so suddenly, I think it's up for grabs. I think one of the things about the Ireland I grew up in when I was a kid, it was very much an island, and it was designed that way, if you know what I mean. There was no pop music radio until I was a teenager. Or actually, I think I might have been 21 before we had a pop. We could get Radio Luxembourg and the BBC, but they tried to keep those pollutants out of the country. African jazz rhythms, things like that. And there was a very strict definition of what it was to be Irish. Ideally, we should speak Gaelic, but we didn't. We spoke English. We shouldn't play soccer. We should play Gaelic games, most of which were invented quite recently as a rival to the garrison sports, as they call them, tennis and rugby and things like that. And, it's a bit like Prohibition. You ban drink and the first thing you want to do is go get a drink. It's a little act of sedition. So it didn't work. That trying to, you know, I've a total respect for the notion of holding on to your roots, but I've sometimes have a problem with the people who choose which roots to hold on to, you know. And as a Dubliner, for example, living in a large city, one was never Irish enough because we were supposed to be rural. Yeah. And as somebody who loved English football, that was a little act of treachery as well. The Christian Brothers actually suspended me from school for going to a football game, you know, an international game. We beat Russia at the height of the Cold War. We beat them 3-0.
Why were you suspended? I don't get that.
Because I went to see a football game. It was in school time, granted, so I was on the hop, so to speak. But if it had been a Gaelic football game, we'd have gone to... We wouldn't... Nothing
there wouldn't have been any school.
No. So, at the moment, then, there's this influx of people. To be honest, most people still don't know how to cope with it, including myself at times. I've been told, you know, do not ask people where they come from. Hmm. It was a question that I had asked in friendliness. So I'd be in the company of Africans, as I have been quite often. I'd say, where do you come from? And they tell me and we talk about it. But somebody took me aside and said, you know, the time has come to stop asking that question. It's
judgmental.
I suppose it's a polite variation of when are you going home? You know, so it's also new that it's up for grabs, which is, again, one of the reasons why I was writing a book set in America in the 20s. You know, if I'm not personally worked up, I don't write it. But I'm worked up about what's happening in Ireland at the moment. And I think it's very similar to what happened in the United States in the early 20th century.
You're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. There's actually a part in the book, and I don't really know, Roddy, how to introduce this without giving away too much of the book, so you're going to help me.
Am I?
Yes, you are. You wrote it. It's your story.
Okay.
We have a reunion here of Henry Smart and Miss O'Shea.
His wife.
And it comes somewhat unexpected to him. But here we have these people who've been separated now for how long?
They were separated for 8 years. When he left Ireland, she was in jail, Kilmainham Jail, quite famous old Victorian building in Dublin, housed diehard Republican women at the time and just after the Civil War. A remarkable thing when you think about it. Women from the age of 12 or 13 right up to 80, they all refused to accept the treaty. Mad, a lot of them, like, mad. It must have been a great, great place, though, you know. But she was in jail. He had only held and kissed and, you know, known his daughter once. She was an infant and he left Ireland. So they've been reunited in a coincidental way that I hope works dramatically. Certainly, it's not.
It's a delight. It's a delight. That's all we have to say. But here they are together. I do want to have you read that because it's apropos of where we are with this understanding what a country means.
Yeah, it's her. It's him trying to explain what it is he's doing, and it's her in a way. Although she's standing on American soil, her head is still in Ireland, and she just doesn't get it. I put my hand out. She didn't meet it. I left it there on the table. It stops, I said. It's like this. They're after us, especially Louis. I'm just with them. And they want to get us and kill us, more than likely. Maybe just hurt Pops. Who's that? Louis. They'll just want to hurt him because they want him to work for them. But they'll kill me because I'm a pain in the arse. She said nothing. I'm in their way. I'm no use to them. So they'll bump me off if they've got to. So, grand. They're after us, but it stops. They're out for us for a while. Then they get on with business. They give up. There's too much to do. It's a big place, all sorts of money to make. It's not weakness, but it's not personal. After a while, they lose interest. They've no memory here. It gets in the way of progress. How do you know all that? I don't, I said. And now I felt fingers take my hand. But I think I do, I said. I think I know. I've been here long enough. It's not like Ireland. They forget here. There's plenty to do. Do you understand? Oh, I do. You like it, don't you? Yeah, I said. I don't. I know.
They've no memory here. It was a sentence in all that that jumped out at me when I read it.
I hoped so.
What are you saying about the country?
I'm saying, I think it's Henry's naivety in a way. But in Ireland, the past is always there, you know. You can never consign anything for history. I think it's probably globally wise never, ever to consign anything safely to history. But Ireland, it's the past all the time, you know. And also what is fascinating about it, it's kind of a fictional version of the past. It's an invented version of the past. I use the example an awful lot, but I do think it strikes home. My great uncle, my father's uncle, joined the army in 1914. Now, he joined the army. He was from Dublin. He joined the army. He survived the war and came back in 1918 in the British Army. In those 4 years, the version of Irishness that I grew up in, if not invented, became current. You know, people who hadn't given a thought to their Irishness really became Republican in their outlook, or nationalist certainly in their outlook. In the last couple of years only, although we've been in the EU since the early 70s, we now are quite comfortable with the notion of being called European, you know. So that it's a shifting definition of Irishness, but there's still always this tendency to draw more on the past than on the present. And I think America, the balance is somewhat different.
We should pick that up when we come back after our break. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Roddy Doyle is my guest. We're talking about his new book, Oh, Play That Thing, which brings his pen and his character, Henry Smart, to America. Is America still, in some ways, writing its own story in this mix of immigrants? Has the notion of being America or coming to America and forgetting it all, reinventing yourself, changed somewhat? Is that even possible today? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Roddy Doyle's my guest. His new book is Oh, Play That Thing. It is the second in a trilogy. The last one's not been written yet. The first one's called A Star Called Henry. In Oh, Play That Thing, Henry Smart, the star, comes to America, 1920s through the sort of bustling streets of New York, on into Chicago, and then later with his family into some of the more desperate years of the Depression and an ending that I'm going to leave you to discover all on your own. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. I wonder whether or not the notion of America from the eyes of a European or an Irishman has changed. I mean, there's obviously the big shift that's happened in the last 3 years. That's mm-hmm. part of our everyday political dialogue. But in even a broader or a more narrow sense, whether or not the idea of America still exists as a place to go to.
Yeah, I think it has become somewhat warped in recent years. But I do think America is still that big place. You know, I still think that, and it's the place of all those great names, you know, all the names that are in Springsteen songs and Dylan songs. And it is a place, I think, where I think people still perceive it as a land of opportunity. But having said that, it probably is a little bit dated and a little bit distorted. I think even though Ireland now is one of the wealthiest countries in the world and itself must be some sort of a land of opportunity, mm-hmm. it still doesn't have that pizzazz. It doesn't have that size. There'll never be a road movie to come out of Ireland because you can drive across the country and get home in time for your dinner. you know.
No Route 66.
I suppose as an Irish person as well, there's no magic in the place names. We're supposed to be surrounded by it, but there's no magic in Ballydiss and, you know, that. So it's always, I suppose, the other man's grass is always greener. Where when you hear place names like, you know, Medicine Bow and Albuquerque, there's a poetry to all of these places. So it is, I think, still seen as a land of opportunity, and a land of where you can get lost in.
Maybe that's why there's been such a European kind of reaction to this change in the America that's projected abroad, because people see that interrupted, they see that disturbed.
Well, it's a generosity of spirit, we would have thought, that is part of America, you know, this place that kept taking in more and more and more people. And I heard Giuliani, Mayor Giuliani on Irish radio only last year, you know, a conservative man or whatever, but he was talking about the necessity of immigration, how New York could not survive without its immigrants. And I thought it was fantastic because, you know, the average conservative politician in Ireland would be saying, in a way, would know it's politically cute to say quite the opposite. Batten down the hatches, lads, no more, we won't take any more. We have to protect what we have.
Right.
You know, so there's a smallness of mind there to match the island in some ways. And I'm speaking as somebody who's very happily Irish, you know, I'm not. I hope I'm not upsetting anybody. I more than likely am, but I hope I'm not. So I think we're a bit frightened as well. To give you an example, the EU now has 25 members. There will be more joining, one of which was more than likely going to be Turkey. Turkey borders Iraq, so we're there. Iraq becomes somehow or other our next door neighbour. You know, so Europe is redefined. Do you know what I mean? And it's all happening all the time. So.
Very quickly, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's not far away. I mean, funnily enough, Yugoslavia, when it exploded and became 7 or 8 different states and all that awfulness and mayhem, that seemed further away. But I think the globe is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. So it is a bit frightening that the world's greatest power doesn't seem to be interested in the rest of the world.
1-800-423-8255, that's the number to join us. We're going to Boston, and Helen's joining us. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. It's my pleasure. I just wanted to say I only tuned in late in the program, but it's wonderful to hear Mr. Doyle. And my family immigrated when I was 9, so I've grown up into my seniority here. And Irishness has always been just a major part of my life. And it's still a pleasure to go back to Ireland. I always love it, but I get tired of the stage Irish.
Can I ask you, Helen, if it's easier to hold on to that little bit of the home country living in Boston, if it would be harder if you were living in Albuquerque, for example?
No, actually, it's always been a part of me. My family, my father took us to Florida, which was a total cultural change. And we grew up, you know, being the only Irish, the only foreigners probably in Miami for quite a while that we knew of.
Yeah.
So, it's just, I guess, how firmly you get rooted in it before you ever leave.
When's the last time you were back home in Ireland? I shouldn't perhaps call it home, but when were you last in Ireland?
Home is home.
Yeah.
August a year ago.
Did you recognize it?
Oh, sure. Well, I'll tell you, the big difference I noticed is between the 60s, when it was so desperately poor, and then after joining the EU, when it really came into its own. And, of course, now it's so, I mean, the farmers and the 8-year-olds all have cell phones.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's a wonderful heritage, and I'm delighted I have it, but I don't think I could ever go back and live.
Why?
It doesn't have the expanse that America has. And I'm new in Boston. I've only been here about 6 years, but the thrill of Boston is you can go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the northeastern part of the country. Living in Florida, it took 8 hours to get out of the state. So
interesting part of Roddy's new book, and this actually comes in the desperate latter part of the book, during the Depression, when this family of Henry Smarts is jumping boxcars and scrounging and stealing and trying to make their way. And at that point, I'm just one of these people who tries to read stuff into something I shouldn't be reading it into, but I was wondering whether or not you were trying to pull them to a point where they were maybe as desperate and unhappy and unfed as people would have been in the 1840s. Have I got the potato famine time right then?
Yeah.
Are you pulling them back to something that their ancestors would have been through?
Yes, and I suppose as well, again, in Europe, we've got these waves of people who are trying to find a home in different parts of Europe. A friend of mine, a director, a great film director, Michael Winterbottom, made a film called In This World, where he followed two, it's a feature film, but very close to reality. There was just him and the two actors and a minimal crew, but they followed them from a refugee camp in northern Pakistan. They were Afghanistani all the way to London. And it was really, because it was handheld camera and it was up close, and you know, you could, it was limited to what they could see. At one point, one of the young men, the survivor, one of them dies on the way. The survivor gets a plank and puts it between the axle, the axles of the Eurostar train that goes under the English Channel. And that's how he gets into England, you know. So it's a variation on holding the rods. There was riding the rods and holding the rods, you know. And it's, you know, there are people doing it all the time, containers full of people, all of them desperate to... Most of them, you know, they're rather branded almost as criminals. They're called economic migrants. And what they are is decent human beings trying to make a living, you know. And I wanted, again, it's this notion that you can't consign things to history. And America had its Great Depression, you know. But the Great Depression is somewhere else at the moment. And it'll be, you know, it'll come back in some shape or form. Maybe not as desperately as it did. But... we, you know, the notion of dividing places into, you know, along strict border lines is quite a quite a recent one. The human history is about movement, and I'm always fascinated by Americans. They never seem to sit still very, very long. I've met very few New Yorkers who come from there. And when I hear, you know, where you're, because all of my family at the moment, because they've all returned home, mm-hmm. all of my family at the moment lives within 3 miles of each other. All my siblings, my mother, my father, we all live within 3 miles of each other, which, you know, that's a different story. But it's a new novel. But in America, people are moving all the time within America.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And still they're a day or two journey apart within America. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Roddy Doyle is my guest. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Next to Attleboro, Massachusetts, Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, my question is, the Irish were the blacks of the British Empire, all right? And the blacks over here in America were like our poor people and the slaves and everything. What happened in Irish history, you know, when they went to Barbados and then when they came over here, they were indentured servants and... everything. They seem to rise, and they should have had more in common with the blacks, but unfortunately, something happened, you know, through the racial riots of the Civil War and things like that. I noticed that you tied in New Orleans, you tied in the black music, you tied in all the things that the poor Irish would be if they were over here as blacks. Do you have a comment or something on what happened between the Irish and what happened with the blacks and why they wouldn't have more in common?
I really don't have a comment. I think, having said that, I probably will say something. But no, I think it's very hard to generalise in that way. You said that the Irish were the blacks of the British Empire. I would disagree with you, because I think actually the Africans were the blacks of the British Empire. Ireland's involvement with the British Empire was more, in a way, interesting and more complicated. We were right next door to Britain, not officially a colony. We had parliamentarians went across to London, but actually a colony. And so there are, in a way, we had our cake but weren't allowed to eat it. And a lot of the patterns, Ireland's population patterns are very like those of a third world state up until very, very recently. So we never had, if you like, the luxury of being, if I may say, the cultural luxury of being a colony, insofar as we could never clearly say that we'd been suppressed. Because, as I said, my great uncle joined the army. He didn't join the British army. It wasn't seen as being a foreign army. So it was a kind of a confused picture. But I don't really know enough to comment on the parallels between the Irish and the black experience.
I'm struck by something that I think you do brilliantly, and I'm wondering if you do it on purpose, and that is that you're always telling your stories about places or about people or about history or about changes through the voices of the working class people. You don't spend a lot of time with those who hold or wield power. I mean, maybe a gangster or something, but you seem to have this real affinity for the voice of working class people wherever they are.
I suppose it's where my interest lies, I suppose, and it's where when you grow up in the north side of Dublin, you know, there's a grey area, which is lower middle class, working class, but there's only one private high school on the north side of Dublin, as far as I know. So it's solid working class area, so it's what I grew up with. I have to explain about power and politicians. Again, one of the good things about Ireland, I mean, sometimes it's a bit like a parish, it's a bit too small. But a Nigerian friend of mine, a journalist who's now working in Ireland, he's a Catholic and was going to Mass. That's another surprise. Just as Irish people are stopping going to Mass, the Africans love Masses. God, Catholic Africans go to 3-hour Masses on a Sunday. They just love it. They can't get enough of it. But he was going to Mass in his local church in Cabra. And the Prime Minister of Ireland, the Taoiseach, Bertie Ahern, was getting out of a car and going up the steps to go to Mass and shaking hands with people and the rest of it. But my Nigerian friend was very, very taken with that and very, very moved with that. The notion that the leader of the country could be so close to people and that he could go up the steps without everybody having to move back 100 yards, that it was, you know, relatively safe for him to do this. Now, there were people looking after him, we can be sure, but that he was so accessible, you know. And that's one of the reasons why, in a way, powerful figures in Ireland, they're not, I suppose they could be the guys who live around the corner. You know, I was watching my son play a football match one summer some years ago, and I realised that I was standing beside one of the most notorious criminals in Dublin, who had a little dog with him, a little dog that you'd expect a romance novelist to carry around in a pink basket, you know? And he was watching his son play.
Did you talk to him?
I did, yeah. I didn't ask him, you know, why are you the most notorious criminal?
Or why do you have such a small dog?
We talked things football. Yep.
Number three. What's the wait time here? What do you expect?
The wait will be considerable because after the second volume, I felt a bit washed out. I was tired of writing about the past, you know, and having said the past is never the past, I was tired of research, I suppose. And it was a long haul. It took 5 years to do. Mm. And in the 8 years I've been working on the first two volumes, Dublin has changed so much that I was itchy to write. I've been writing stories and plays, but I was itchy to write a novel of some sort that was in contemporary Dublin. So when I've done that, and I don't think it'll take very long, I'm working on it even as we speak, I'll go on to the third volume. So sometime in the next 20 years, it should be ready.
I'll mark it on my calendar. I want to thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Roddy Doyle, author of Oh, Play That Thing, as well as a number of other books, including Paddy Clark, Ha Ha Ha, which won him the Booker Prize in 1993. This one is the second in a trilogy, and the next one is coming along shortly. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.